Okay. Bist du bereit, deine Karriere auf die Überholspur zu setzen? Denn das Speed Recruiting Event der Service Plan Group am 30.04. im House of Communication in München bietet dir dafür die perfekte Gelegenheit. In einem kurzen Talk hast du die Möglichkeit, verschiedene Agenturen und deren RecruiterInnen mit deinem persönlichen Elevator Pitch zu überzeugen. Ob du eine kreative Visionärin bist oder eine ambitionierte Bewerberin, Serviceplan lädt dich ein, diese einzigartige Chance zu nutzen. Erhalte tiefe Einblicke in die dynamische Arbeitswelt der Serviceplan Group und knüpfe wertvolle Kontakte. Lerne aus den Erfahrungen anderer und stell dich der Herausforderung des Speed Recruitings. Also, warum warten? Gib deiner Karriere den Turbo Boost, denn sie verdient es, und melde dich jetzt zum Speed Recruiting bei der Serviceplan Group in München an. Den Link mit allen Infos zum Speed Recruiting findest du in der Beschreibung dieser Folge.
Yeah, it's like my first kind of proper meeting with somebody, kind of like that. And it was, I went in and said, and he said, "Oh, can I get you a drink?" And I said, "Oh, I've got orange juice." And he said, "It's not a goddamn bar, man." And he was like, and it was just this whole, because he was from New York. He was like this amazing character and kind of, but yeah, he just saw something in me and just, gave me free rein to do work for MTV. So yeah, it's cool.
This is Ohne den Hype. My name is Sven Jürgensmeier and my guest today is the graphic artist, Anthony Burrell. Anthony combines his love for analog craft skills with positive messages. His work is instantly recognizable. His pieces all bear the marks of his letterpress process and all its joyful idiosyncrasies. His work is also held in the permanent collections of many museums and exhibited all around the world. We talked about the many lives of Anthony Burrell, about summer jobs, his early work in web design, his work for MTV, cultural changes, weird books, David Hockney, and I had a chance to psychoanalyze him a little bit. Oh, and by the way, thanks to Daniel Schimal. Daniel was one of the first people to support the show on Patreon, and that definitely helps to keep the lights on around here. So if you also want to pitch in, check out patreon.com/ohnedenhype. You'll find the link, of course, also here in the description and on my website. And as always, you'll find full show notes with the links to all the topics we talked about on ohnedenhype.substack.com. And there you can also subscribe to the show notes so that from now on, you'll get them with the release of every episode straight to your inbox. That link is also, of course, in the description for this episode. And now, here is Anthony Burrell.
Hi there.
There you are.
Yeah. Sorry, I just, my laptop stopped working. So I just had to bring my Mac into this, into this different room.
Ah, okay. Be honest, you just let me wait because last time I didn't even show up.
All right, okay. So we're even, man.
It's payback.
This room's, it's less echoey, so the sound should be a little bit better.
Nice. Well, then, thanks a lot for taking the effort of bringing. You have a big old iMac or something, I assume, or? Then.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's actually quite an effort, so you're forgiven.
Okay, thank you.
How's it going? How's the weather in on an island? Actually, sounds more sunny than it probably is, huh?
Yeah, it's it was an island up until the 11th century.
Oh, really? It's not actually an island anymore?
No. It's still called the Isle of Oxney.
Mm-hmm.
But the water levels changed and it became, I think they reclaimed the land around the island to turn it into farmland. So.
Okay.
But this area is still called the Isle of Oxney.
So ah, funny. Called, I did not know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a mix of man-made changes and the water levels actually sinking.
Oh. Yeah. So our village, so on the island, there are three villages. Ours is the largest village of the three. So yeah, it's great.
But so it's I actually have to look it up on Google Maps. So it's is there any resemblance to an island? Is it just a little strip of land that's connecting it to the mainland, or?
Yeah, when you drive to it, it's surrounded by really flat land, almost mm-hmm. like in the Netherlands or something. So it's kind of like, it's very flat, kind of cultivated land. And then where we are, it's like a hill that's mm-hmm. from the flat land. So yeah.
That's not where you're originally from, right?
No, I'm from near Manchester originally.
Okay.
Yeah, just outside Manchester. That's where I grew up.
And no desire to go back there?
Not really. I think I moved down to London in the late 80s, and that's where I met my wife, and my wife is from Kent, so we ended up here.
Okay, and you moved to London to go to school, right?
Yeah, to do my MA at the Royal College of Art.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. What came before that? What made you decide to go into a design or artistic career?
Well, from as early as I can remember, I was obsessed with drawing and, you know, kind of, and yeah, any kind of creativity. I was kind of hungry for that stuff. I used to watch, when I was a little kid, I'd watch cartoons and, draw superheroes. And, I think I was really, I was really kind of connected visually with all that stuff. And then as soon as I found out about artists like Roy Lichtenstein and Salvador Dali and, just kind of like the real kind of almost like cartoon-like images of mm-hmm. their work, I was really drawn into that. So, and then when I was at secondary school, all my friends were into football and all that stuff. And I was kind of the odd one out, I was an absolutely terrible at football. And I found my refuge in the art department at school. I had two really good art teachers who really encouraged me. And I think it's just like in the art room, they had lots of interesting, work by past students, and then lots of examples and of amazing artwork and books. And I would just be in there all the time, hungry for all that stuff.
But were you comfortable being kind of the nerdy kid? I mean, it's a weird position to be in, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, I was kind of, I had a good group of friends, and I was kind of, I wasn't a complete nerd, but I was definitely on the kind of nerdy end. Yeah. I was kind of, I suppose, in between the sport guys and the nerds.
Okay.
I kind of had a foot in each camp, really.
So you were the missing link, basically.
Yeah, definitely.
So there was no question about it, basically. You just wanted to become an artist. Very early on.
Yeah. I think I just saw it as, there's a really great TV show on UK TV called The South Bank Show. And it was like every Sunday evening, it was like an hour long documentary about a different artist or creative. So, ranging from composers to contemporary musicians to artists. And so, I remember watching one about David Hockney, and just his entire life just looked incredibly exciting and interesting. They interviewed him sat by the side of his pool in Los Angeles, and because Hockney was from Bradford, which wasn't too far from where I grew up. So mm-hmm. I kind of thought, well, he's from Bradford, he went to the Royal College of Art, and he's doing all these amazing, exciting, interesting things now. So I kind of, I maybe saw him as a, some kind of example to lead from.
Mm-hmm. You picked a few quite colorful characters there. Lichtenstein, mm-hmm. Salvador Dali. I mean, doesn't get more colorful than Dali, basically. And then Hockney. Just the personalities there were just so outgoing, and kind of like Warhol or all those others during that time. Yeah. And you strike me as more of a quiet person.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I kind of, you know, I have my moments of, you know, exuberance, but I don't know. I think I'm just drawn to that. I don't know. Those people we've talked about, they seemed like, you know, the entry into a different world. You know, mm-hmm. I grew up in, you know, it's kind of, you know, kind of post-industrial kind of background, you know, Manchester, you know, even though Manchester is a cultural, you know, center for music and art and everything, it still felt like I had to go to London to kind of find my people in a way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think I'm drawn to quite strong personalities. And I think I've got a strong personality myself, but it doesn't, you know, I'm not like a kind of crazy character. You know, I like to be part of a group, but, you know, maybe not the center of attention.
Yeah. I've seen a few of your talks, and I mean, I don't want to start to psychoanalyze you here or anything, but, seems to me that you have a strong personality, as in you are quite comfortable with who you are and how you are. Mm. Actually, very comfortable with that. But on the other hand, you're very quiet. So it might seem like you're more withdrawn or unsure at times. But when I see you speak, I can see that it's not nervousness necessarily, but it's not like this is the moment you've been living for. You've been waiting for all your life to be on stage.
Yeah.
But you have something to say and you're very comfortable saying it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a fair analysis of the way that I operate. You know, I kind of, you know, I've got a healthy sense of humor as well. I don't take myself too seriously. And especially, you know, within the context of a design conference, you know, it is kind of a weird atmosphere. You know, there's lots of people there who've come to listen to designers talk about their work. And, you know, I think sometimes people put on a kind of show that's not necessarily them. And I think for me, I want to kind of walk on stage and still be the same person, you know, I was, you know, last week when I was, mm-hmm. you know, just with my family or whatever. So I think it's, I suppose, like my version of my, you know, the way I kind of talk about my work is I just try and keep it honest and keep mm-hmm. it really, you know, I never pretend to have all the ideas or all the solutions. I'm constantly unsure about my own work and, you know, where it fits in and what it means. And, you know, especially with like such a, you know, over the past few years, the way that culture has changed so much, it's like, I think you have to constantly question your own work and see what it means to people.
What kind of change do you mean in the last 2 years culturally?
Well, yeah, I think during lockdown, I think people kind of had more time to kind of think about their lives and where their lives were going and, you know, how, if they were satisfied with what they were doing or, you know, and I think we've seen a kind of, I don't know, we've all become kind of disillusioned with, you know, politics and, you know, ways of life that were kind of forced upon us through, you know, commercial advertising and, you know, kind of, it, you know, it all felt like, you know, maybe like 10, 15 years ago, I think things were much, I don't know, it's almost like you were a consumer and you were kind of part of this machine that was kind of moving forward constantly without any kind of question about it. But I think lockdown kind of, you know, it dropped anchor on all that stuff. It kind of, we came to a grinding halt. And I think now we're kind of, you know, I thought in my head, I thought we'd just pick up where we left off, you know, it would be a pause, but then things would carry on. But I think things just feel different now. You know, we've all gone through, you know, quite a traumatic time. You know, people have lost family members and, you know, it's been you know, it was, it's crazy to think of what we've all lived through. And I think it's affected all of us in different ways. You know, we're still trying to figure all this stuff out. And I think making the kind of work that I make, I think it has an effect on the kind of things that I'm talking about now. So, you know, I'm thinking about ideas of community and connection and friendship, and, you know, really valuing all those kind of support networks that kind of helped us through the past 2 years. And yeah, it's kind of, I'm just not sure. I don't think anybody knows what, you know, what's going to happen next.
No, I think it will take probably a decade or longer to be able to judge what this really did to us. Because I get mixed reports. Like, some people are like you and say, well, we all had time to think, and it's more about, well, how we relate to the world, or not so much about buying things, going out and stuff. And but to be, I mean, I'm always more a bit of the negative guy, to be honest. But I don't really see it. Like, especially here in Munich, in the city, it seems like everybody's just racing to get back to the way things were before. Yeah. And yeah. I hear when I talk to agencies, advertising agencies or all of that kind of stuff, they're super busy right now because everybody wants to go to the parties and get catch up on all the things they couldn't do over the last 2 years. So I don't know. I mean, and I think it will take a few years to really see where it went. But I think, on the other hand, I don't want to take that away from you at all, because I think it's a very good push for you to make different work from what you did before, which is, I guess, always good.
And I think, you know, as a creative, you're always looking for the next thing to be inspired by, and, you know, stuff that kind of, you know, gets you going and gets that you know, that creative engine running again.
But when you wanted to go to art school very early on, what did your parents think about that? Did they want you to go into something more of a solid, sensible career, or were they happy with it?
No. They were complete. It was like, well, you know, if that's what you want to do, you know, we're 100% behind it. You know, I was the first person from my family to go into further education. So, you know, for them, it was a big deal that I was going to university. And then, you know, kind of, so yeah, I did my degree, then I did an MA, and it was, you know, my dad was, he was like, so you're going to be a student all your life? And I said, well, I'm going to try to be, you know, I'm going to try and avoid, you know, not having to get a real job.
Mm-hmm. And how did you finance yourself during that time?
Well, in those days, you know, college was, you could get, you know, all your fees were paid for by the government, and you got an allowance and things like that.
You got an allowance from the government?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, because the background I came from, you know, wasn't, you know, wasn't the most...
affluent.
So, yeah, privileged. So yeah, I kind of got, you know, got bursaries and things and stuff. And then when I was at college as well, you know, I'd have jobs during the summer and all that stuff.
I heard you had one job during the summer putting the caps on toothpaste or something like that.
It's actually shampoo.
Shampoo, which seems really like the worst thing I could imagine, doing that all day.
Yeah, it was fun. It was kind of like, you know, it's kind of, you know, being, you know, I'd come from, you know, a fairly kind of quiet upbringing, and then, you know, to be in, you know, like a kind of factory environment with all these other people, and, you know, because the students would just be there during the summer, and, you know, the real workers would hate the students, and, you know, we'd all get the worst jobs to do. But it's funny, you know, you kind of learn about life doing that stuff. You know, you learn about different aspects of life. But yeah, I've always enjoyed, you know, repetition and doing things. Yeah, so, you know, yeah, I was quite into it. I was really good at putting tops and bottles and champagne.
Did you put that on your resume afterwards?
Yeah.
Very good at putting tops on shampoo bottles.
Anything you need to be screwed on, you know.
Call Anthony. He's your man.
I'm the person to do that, yeah.
Fantastic. And so you try to prolong the whole college thing as long as possible then, yeah?
Yeah. And I think even after graduating, you know, my first studio was in the dining room table. You know, like a lot of people graduating at that time in the early 90s, most of my friends set up their own practice, you know, from day one, really. We had a couple of friends who got real jobs at design agencies, but they were just sellouts, you know. they weren't cool like we were. You know, we just want to kind of, create our own stuff and find our own clients, really.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you've never been employed in your life except for those summer jobs.
Yeah, not since the shampoo factory days. Yeah, I've kind of I did a little bit of work. Worked for Terry Jones, who did ID magazine. So I answered the phone in his studio for a couple of weeks.
Did you?
And did bits of photocopying, and that was cool. But it was kind of, I suppose in those days, you know, I didn't know how to use a computer. You know, I was still, you know, my main way of working was using the photocopier. So everything was kind of handmade and hands-on. And I kind of stuck with that for a while. And I think in those days, people were looking for people who could use a computer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going back to the kind of not being a nerd, you know, almost like kind of being between, you know, the kind of cool people and the nerds, you know, I'm kind of still in between. I've always kind of in between things. I never like to be sort of defined as one thing, really.
And I think it's a big strength to be able to combine things like that. I mean, if you want to stick with the word nerdy, just because it's the easiest. The nerdier you are, the more I think you could define it as somebody who is going all in on something and is really dedicated to something. And maybe the social aspects get left behind a little bit during that. And I think people like that have a very hard time marketing themselves or putting themselves in positions where they could bring out the full potential of what they what they have learned. And on the other hand, you have those people that are, you know, very big mouth and not a lot behind it. And I mean, both, like in big companies, probably you need both, I guess, if you have a lot of specialization. But I think for freelancers like you and I and millions of other people, I think if you have a combination of both, that is really the sweet spot where you are.
Yeah.
You're decent at what you do, but you can also interact with people and make them and show them that you are very good at what you do.
I think it's been able to kind of shift between those areas. So, you know, when you have to be somebody who can talk about your work and, you know, sort of, you know, verbally explain what you're doing, like we're doing now, you know, we can just chat about stuff. And I think we both understand each other about the kind of things we're talking about. Whereas if you kind of go into extreme detail about things, then, you know, you're kind of narrowing down how people are going to relate to that stuff. So I think it's a matter of kind of having that in-depth knowledge of a subject, but being able to talk about it and draw people into the things that you're interested in.
And from what I've heard, MTV was kind of like your lucky break in a way.
Yeah.
How did that come about and when?
At the end of the MA at the Royal College, we had a degree show, and I'd made a tape slide animation piece using 12 different slide projectors, projecting 35mm slides to, you know, to kind of all, they were all projected on the same screen to give the impression of animation. And it was all linked together by an ancient computer and a kind of reel-to-reel tape soundtrack. So it was really super old-fashioned, but I'd kind of created this weird animation using typography and imagery. And it kind of stood out. It was part of the animation showreel, and it really stood out, you know, against like stop motion animation and, you know, kind of drawn things. So a guy called Peter Darity, who was the creative director of MTV Europe, saw my work and just came up to me and gave me his business card and said, you know, come see me and, you know, let's chat to you about working for MTV.
But in what kind of circumstance did he actually get to see it?
Yeah, it was early in the degree show.
So he came to the degree show. So he was already like scouting for talent.
Yeah. So yeah, so I suppose, you know, it's like your ideal scenario where you have a piece of work in the degree show.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, when they finally make the film of my life, you know, that's going to be an amazing kind of pivotal scene, definitely.
That's why I said lucky break and not just your big break, because I think there is in every career, I think there's a huge amount of luck involved that you're just at the right moment in the right position, or the right people see your work at the right time and all of that. Because I mean, you might still be successful, but who knows if you would be as successful if you hadn't had that particular interaction that early on in your career.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible that, you know, when you think about, I think the thing that you have to do is just do your work and send the signals out, and hopefully someone, you know, somebody else is going to pick up on that stuff. And I think Peter saw something, you know, in the kind of work that I was doing that was kind of quite different to what everybody else was doing. You know, I was coming from a slightly different angle, and, you know, I was kind of still, you know, I was into kind of weird stuff in those days, you know, kind of like UFOs and, you know, crop circles. And, you know, I'm still into all that, you know, kind of esoteric stuff. But yeah, so he just said, yeah, come see me at MTV. And it took me about 2 or 3 months to kind of pluck up the courage to actually go and see him. And when I went there, he was like, it's like my first kind of proper meeting with somebody, you know, kind of like that. And it was, I went in and he said, oh, can I get you a drink? And I said, oh, I've got orange juice. And he said, it's not a goddamn bar, man. And it was like, and it was just this hope, because he was from New York. He was like this amazing character and kind of, but yeah, he just saw something in me and just, you know, gave me free rein to do work for MTV. So yeah, it's cool.
Mm-hmm. Talking about esoteric things and weird stuff, have you ever seen a book called Be Here Now by Ramdas? Kind of spiritual thing.
I think
you'll love it. It was Ramdas was what was his name? He was this Stanford, some Ivy League professor, and he started experimenting with LSD in the 60s, I want to say, together with Timothy Leary.
Yeah.
And then I think both of them got chucked out of the university. And then this guy went to India, and additionally to the LSD stuff, he also got big time into Hinduism and found his guru there and stuff like that. And then he came back to the US and became this hippie superstar, I guess, kind of thing.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
Then he put out this book called Be Here Now, and it's, I mean, the essence is it's all about, you know, being in the moment and meditation and all the kind of thing. But it is laid out in a way. Give me a second. I'll see if I can find it. I have it here.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, this is great podcast material where people can't see what we're talking about. But it's this kind of stuff.
Wow, that was amazing.
Yeah. And it's all just one font and drawings and just all laid out and on this cheap paper. And it is, I think you'll love it. You can get it on Amazon or something. I'll send you a link.
Okay.
It's fantastic.
I instantly want that.
Yeah, I thought if you didn't know it already, I thought you would.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah.
But I mean, you were in exactly the right time as well. I mean, you had David Carson, Neville Brody, Stefan Sagmeister, and you. I mean, you all came up during the 90s, right? And it was all very type-heavy and unconventional with the type. Is that a kind of crowd that you see yourself connected to, or...?
I suppose maybe they're just a little bit older than me. You know, when I was at college, I don't know, I was looking more at kind of like DIY stuff and, you know, kind of, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I never really kind of saw myself as part of that group, really. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's kind of, yeah, I was definitely, you know, in that cultural moment, you know, the whole, especially, you know, the 90s in London, you know, kind of, you know, lots of, you know, kind of like Tomato and, you know, people like Jonathan Barnbrook and, you know, Why Not Associates and Fuel, don't need to remember them, Miles Murray, Sorrel, Fuel. But yeah, there's lots of like smaller agencies and we were all looking at, you know, kind of, I suppose, like tactile, handmade graphics, but then through the filter of you know, emerging technology. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know, there was a book about creative uses of the fax machine that Angus Highland at Pentagram designed. And it was like, you know, I had some work in this book called Fax You, and it was like, you know, everyone was kind of using the fax as this, you know, cutting edge bit of technology. It's crazy. To think back.
Those yeah. There has been another book, I don't know who by, but somebody basically just photocopied a blank sheet of paper like 400 times and just made a book out of it. And the whole page would just degrade and degrade until it was almost all black in the end.
I think that, you know, the analog feel of the photocopier was, you know, I was obsessed with it, you know, kind of putting different paper through it, you know, jamming the copier constantly, you know, it, you know, like the maintenance guy would always be in every week.
They would hate you.
And I'm going, what have you been putting through this machine? Uh-huh. They'd be like tracing paper and sandpaper. And, you know, it's like, but I think because it had that such an immediate feel to it, you know, it's kind of, it was much quicker than screen print or, you know, and cheaper than screen print or letterpress or anything like that. So yeah, I used to look, and I think I'm still connected to that aesthetic, you know, and the work that I make now is still grounded in that, you know, that kind of technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I have a slight difficult technical problem here.
Okay.
Can I get back to you in like 5 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, here we are again.
Back again.
Yeah, I had to, I don't know, change my plan on Zoom or something. They were basically just wanted to cut me off.
Okay.
But I did make good use of the time, and I actually sent you the link for the book already.
Oh, right, amazing. I'll check it.
Yeah. I don't know if you're an Amazon guy or if Amazon is the devil for you. It seems like there's two kinds of people in this world.
Well, if I can buy from, you know, an independent bookstore, then I'll get it there. But then if, you know, if you have to get it from Amazon, you know, so be it.
Yeah, you will probably find it in other places as well. I'm just a lazy bastard and I find that it's the easiest for other people. Where were we? I think MTV. And where did it go from there? How long did you work for MTV? I know you did at least one set of animations for them.
Yeah. It was probably, I worked for them maybe for a couple of years, you know, kind of doing different things. So like, you know, the interstitial bits in between the music videos and the TV commercials and then, you know, things like menus for what was coming up during the next week.
How big of a deal was it for you? Because I remember when I was young in the 90s, it was those things were, they were just amazing. And I think every 6 months or so they were changed and it was always very cutting edge for the time visually.
Yeah.
It was a big deal when the new set came out. It was a big deal for me.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, Peter said, you know, you've got 30 seconds of airtime to film, you know, just do your thing with it. I was like, okay. So, you know, in a way it's kind of quite daunting to think, mm-hmm. right, I've got to do something now that is kind of weird and interesting. And, you know, I think it was, you know, I'd kind of worked with an operator to on a Quantel paint box to create the imagery. And then mm-hmm. I think we went into like a kind of offline edit suite to kind of edit all the things together. So, you know, it was kind of painstaking the way that everything was stitched together. You know, it's kind of pre things like After Effects or mm-hmm. any of that kind of software. So everything had to be done in these super expensive edit suites, you know, with kind of editors and, you know, kind of creating the sound as well. We'd go into the sound studio to make the soundtrack. And, you know, it was just like, for me, it was just like, wow, this is, mm-hmm. you know, it was like going into a different world. And, it, you know, it's the world I wanted to be in, and the world, you know, like, you know, going to an edit suite and, you know, it'd be air conditioned and, you know, they'd offer you drinks and, you know, what would you like for lunch and all this stuff.
So, did you finally get your orange juice in the editing suite then?
Yeah, I did.
They did have a goddamn bar.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. So, you know, it's kind of, I suppose, kind of getting in on stuff like that. You just want to do more of it. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's probably like a couple of years I did stuff for MTV and I kind of helped out on a few different shoots. And there's this musician called Scanner, kind of electronic musician. So I got him in and we kind of created this series of idents with a producer friend of mine, Tomas. And, you know, it was really kind of creative time, and you could kind mm-hmm. of do, you know, as long as you got the work past Peter and then past the, you know, overall creative guy at the top, it was cool. You know, you could just do whatever you wanted, really.
But then didn't have market research on everything.
No, nothing like that. It was like, you know, I suppose, it, you know, they adopted the original MTV plan, which was just to make stuff that wasn't like any other TV channel at the time. So, you know, it was kind of, I was doing lots of things with, you know, flying saucers and mm-hmm. typography and, you know, kind of creating an animation and then refilming it off the TV with a, you know, with a video camera and saturating the colors so that they were kind of illegal, you know, just kind of stuff like that, really.
Mm-hmm. I have been looking for them and I couldn't find them anywhere. I wasn't sure which ones they were. Do you know where you can find them these days? Is there anything?
I've got some old U-matic tapes in the attic.
But that's it. They're not on YouTube or anything.
No, it's kind of, it's pre, I think maybe some of that stuff was digitized, but yeah, it's kind of been lost, really, a lot of that material.
You have to do it somehow. There must be a way how you can get it into the computer. I would love to see those. I'm sure I must have seen them in the 90s then, if it was MTV Europe, because that was right about the time when I got mad for music and everything.
But of
course I can't remember. I was probably like, I don't know, 10, 12.
But yeah, no, it's cool. And it's like, you know, every time you, because, you know, they worked with a lot of my friends at the time as well. And, you know, you'd kind of bump into people there. And, you know, it's the beginning of being involved in that world. And yeah, mm-hmm. it felt great.
And how did it go on from then? Did your career just explode? That was your big thing. And then everybody knew you, everybody loved you, and you just got every job in the world.
Well, I'd like to say that's how it happened. But yeah, it was just like it was a very gradual thing, you know. I started doing work in advertising agencies. So, you know, they'd see stuff on MTV and they'd show it to a client, and then the client would say, "Yeah, we want that kind of thing." So, you know, they'd ask me in to kind of do my thing within TV commercials. So I did a couple of kind of decent campaigns, you know, where I was doing, my typography was used within TV commercials. And that was great. You know, I was going into, you know, in Soho in London, going to production facilities and, you know, again, ordering lunch and, you know, orange juice and things. You know, it was like, wow, the food's free. Uh-huh. So, you know, it was just great being in that environment. And, you know, everyone was like, you know, I think it was a time of real creativity, you know, within advertising. So, yeah, so I was doing that stuff. And then I met Eric Kessels, and that's when things kind of really started happening, I suppose.
But did you plan or think that you would work with animation so much? Because nowadays, I mean, you do mostly print, right? And
it
feels like print was is more close to your heart in a way than the animation stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I think just because I was doing something different, and it was kind of, it had a real kind of personality to it, kind of stuff that I was doing. You know, I had kind of the way we'd kind of edit it with the sound, and, you know, it'd be kind of quite crazy. And, you know, for us, yeah, just coming from a different place, really. You know, mm-hmm. I kind of didn't really know what I was doing. So I think that's, it kind of had a kind of naive charm about it.
And remind me again, what year are we in then?
I suppose it's kind of like mid-90s.
Mid-90s. So,
yeah, kind of like 96, 97. So, yeah, I graduated in 91, and all this stuff took maybe 5 years to sort of develop.
Okay, so we have another quarter of a century to come up to today. So
Yeah. So after that, so I met Eric Kessels, and I did the Hans Brinker Budget Hotel campaign. And that was the first one that kind of got lots of attention, and, you know, got in all the design magazines. And after that, I was kind of more in demand for kind of doing advertising stuff. I was kind of dabbling in early internet website design as well with my brother-in-law. So he was the first person. So this is kind of like, 97, 98, mm-hmm. The kind of dawn of the internet.
That's when I started to get into web design as well, tables. All of that. It was terrible. And in hindsight, it was horrible.
Yeah, it was horrific. But it was kind of Kip, my brother-in-law. He was a few years younger than me. He was really, he just kind of got a grip on all that stuff. So we designed a website and then put that online. It's really simple looping animations. And then Kraftwerk got in touch and asked us to make their website. So I was like, okay, let's go. Because I'd always been a massive, huge Kraftwerk fan. You know, they were like, you know, central to everything for me.
But they must have been really early actually in having a website then, right? I mean, during that time, I think, I might be wrong on this, but I think there's a story going around that McDonald's was offered the domain mcdonalds.com in, I want to say the late 90s, mid-90s, late 90s. Yeah, and they were just like, I don't think we really need it. And we'll see in a few years. And of course, then it was gone and they had to buy it for millions or something. Yeah, so, I mean, it was not like everybody saw the opportunities and just jumped on it.
Yeah. And no, it's crazy. Yeah, I remember having a conversation with my wife saying, you know, this internet thing, it's not going to catch on. You know, it's always going to be this kind of niche thing that, you know, just maybe a few people are interested in.
But it did seem like that. It was such a nice to have kind of thing, more like video games, you know. It was like if you're into that kind of stuff, I guess you can. But I mean, nobody believed in the late 90s that we would, I mean, if you took away my phone today, it would take me 3 months to learn how to operate like a normal human being again, probably.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you know, just us chatting now, you know, this is, you know, this was unimaginable. This is like science fiction.
It's still weird to me. That's one thing the whole pandemic also changed. Before that, I was very opposed to any kind of Zoom call or that kind of thing. And now, well, the necessity taught me to kind of work with it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think we've all become more comfortable with kind of communicating, you know, like FaceTime and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I still kind of find it weird seeing my own face, though. You know, I don't like that.
Well, I mean, you can make that window very small. I think you can probably even turn it off somehow.
Yeah.
But it is always very tempting to kind of check yourself. And it's very discomforting because you normally don't see yourself moving in any way, really, especially not real time. So yeah, I try not to pay any attention to that. That would be.
Sounds good. But yeah. So then, like, after the kind of Kraftwerk stuff, you know, we did more music industry. We worked with a few more bands and did their websites. But it was almost like, you know, that those few years of the internet being kind of exciting and different, it slowly began to, you know, kind of channel into, you know, everybody kind of wanting the same thing, really.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like early 2000s. So, you know, for a while I thought, right, I'm going to be a website designer. That's my thing, you know. So I kind of did that for a bit, but then kind of always kind of crept back to making posters and screen prints and things.
But sorry for interrupting there, but how did you get on with the computer part of that? Because, I mean, when you learned, there was no computers around at all. So you had kind of a late start to it. I mean, I started to get into computers when I was like 16 or something, which I think is a kind of a sweet spot because you actually kind of grow up with them. So with the websites, did you design the stuff and then your brother-in-law coded it? Or did you start coding as well? Or how did that go?
Yeah, it would be, I suppose it's like when I was in my late 20s, I got an iMac. So it's when the iMac came out, really.
That big bulbous blue one, that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, like the little desktop one, you know.
Yeah. And they had them in all kinds of colors. That was the first one, wasn't it? Yeah, we had one of those in the company, yeah.
I had the graphite gray.
Oh, you know, fancy.
It's like wire. Look at me, you know, with the kind of round mouse on it.
Oh, that puck mouse, that was horrible. My hand hurts just thinking about it.
When I got that, and then, you know, we had a dial-up internet connection. So, and I think I had a, you know, something like a kind of early version of Photoshop. So I'd just design the pages, mm-hmm. and then Kip would code the stuff. But then, you know, we kind of worked together on a lot of the way that we use lots of sound on our site. So there was lots of kind of sound toys, and you could, with the Kraftwerk site, we kind of got the stems of the tracks, so we could have the, you know, the backing of Autobahn and the kind of vocoder voice. You could kind of trigger it at different points. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's kind of like really rudimentary stuff, but really fun to work with.
Did you use a lot of Flash then in the early 2000s? Yeah. Because it sounds like that's the kind of thing, right?
Yeah, it was all Flash.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we got invited to be in exhibitions and things. We went to we were part of an exhibition in Geneva, and, you know, they flew us out there, and we had this kind of wall of monitors, and, you know, with these looping animations on. We were in an exhibition in the Barbican in London and a few other things, and we, you know, began to get a bit of attention. And at the same time, there were companies like Anti-Rom and Tomato doing interactive stuff, in a company called Airside as well. So we were kind of like within that kind of gang, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So web design.
Yeah.
I didn't know about that, actually. It seems so far off right now from what you do right now. I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I suppose, you know, it was like a new thing to kind of play with and kind of work with. So I was kind of doing that stuff, and then doing the more kind of commercial advertising work. And, you know, I worked on lots of commercials, ended up directing TV commercials, and did live action and stuff like that, which is completely out of my comfort zone.
So with human beings, acting humans and stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, okay. doing stuff.
But how did you get into that?
Well, I got picked up by a production company, and then, you know, working, you know, kind of doing pitches for commercials. So most of it will be kind of graphic with animations, and then with bits of live action in between the graphics and things. And did a few, pop videos and stuff like that.
I imagine like 90s advertising for Coca-Cola or Fanta, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Popping up in places, that kind of
It's kind of, I did a lot of kind of food and drink stuff, you know, kind of breakfast cereal and kind of stuff like for kids and all that stuff. Yeah, it's crazy.
How did you like doing that?
Yeah, kind of after a certain point, I was like, this isn't the route I want to go down. I suppose, you know, there was like, if you started doing TV commercials, then you started to become a director and you'd have to be working on pitches constantly to try and win a campaign. And yeah, it was a route I didn't really want to go down.
But you were still a freelancer at that time, because you said you weren't employed, right? So
Yeah.
You were just coming in on projects and then leaving again.
So at a certain point I had like five different agents, and like I had an agent in New York, one in Paris, a couple of different people in London. You know, I was like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I think it was, I was kind of maybe sort of chasing something that wasn't really me. Mm-hmm. After a certain point, it was like, I was in an exhibition in Breda in the south of the Netherlands. It was curated by Eric Kessels, who's always been like, you know, an important figure in my development. And I was in this exhibition with other people, and they were doing really interesting work and interesting things. And I was kind of thinking, I'd want to do more of this, like exhibitions and art and stuff that kind of means something to me, rather than doing a TV commercial for, you know, kids' breakfast cereal.
But I assume the TV commercials made you comfortable enough for a few years to change directions and do your own thing then, hey?
Yeah. So at that stage, we'd moved out of London. We'd had our kids by then. And yeah, we had, you know, had a house in the countryside. And you know, it was all great. But then it was like, there's something else I want to do. Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, I had a difficult conversation with my agent, and I said, you know, I want to quit for all. Mm-hmm. And she was like, what, for 6 months? I said, no, for good. You know, that's it. It's kind of, and so I kind of spent a year or so then kind of figuring out what happened next. And that's when I started working with the letterpress printers to make posters. And that's when I did Work Hard and Be Nice to People. Mm-hmm.
So you kind of went back 15 years to what you were doing back then.
Yeah. But to, it wasn't, you know, kind of looking back on it now, it kind of, you know, it all seems quite obvious really. But at the time it's like, you know, my wife was supportive and she was like, you know, if you know, we'll figure out a way out of doing it. So we made this poster, and then, you know, very slowly began to sell copies of the poster and kind of printing more copies of it to sell. And then all of a sudden I had this range of different things that I was selling, you know, direct to galleries and, you know, through my own website as well. And it was like, yeah, it's kind of like a way, you know, way of working that you can be self-sufficient and make your own work on your own terms, and you know, you don't have to do things you don't want to do. Mm-hmm.
But do you think any of the stuff you did before helped you to get, well, before you did your own thing, more clients, and later then to sell stuff? Because it seems to me like you had four very distinct careers, each one very successful, but it seems like they are almost unrelated to each other.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I was kind of making a name for myself within the sort of design world, and, you know, kind of being picked up on, you know, for, you know, to be included in publications and you know, I had a fairly decent profile, I suppose, within the design world, but then making my own work and, you know, it kind of expanded that, you know, the people who knew what I was doing. So, and then, you know, then eventually social media came along, you know, that kind of has kind of grown, you know, to a crazy extent now.
Did you see social media? Did you see the opportunity early on? Or I don't know when you got on like Instagram or something like that.
Yeah. I think, right from the start with Instagram. Because around the time I was working on a website for a band, and we were talking, because, you know, we'd all just started getting digital cameras in those days, and they're really, you know, like a little Sony digital camera, so you could take these little pics, and, you know, it was great. So the idea of the website was that the band would take a picture in the studio every day and post it on the website. And, you know, there must have been something in the air in those days, this kind of like user-generated content where people would have, you know, they'd take a photograph of the book they were reading or, you know, and kind of post it. And it was almost like then Instagram came along and it was a similar kind of, you know, the idea of sharing your day-to-day life then became, kind of interesting, really.
But I think it's still irresistible. I mean, imagine if you had in the 80s, in the late 80s, the chance to see David Hockney's day-to-day life. He would just post Instagram stories. You'd have been all over that, wouldn't you?
I would have been. I would have been a subscriber, definitely. But yeah. But I think because, you know, I started working with letterpress and screen prints, you know, quite analog things, but I would document them and share the process. And, you know, I think that's, you know, when people see the process that's involved in, you know, making the prints and, you know, it kind of gives them an insight into my kind of creativity.
And also with digital coming up so much at that time, I think it very early on people started to crave the analog side to a certain degree, and then of course that became a huge hype in the last few years, and it might be actually going down a little bit now. I think it's getting more integrated now that people have both in a way, but
yeah,
I want to say in like the mid teens, I hate talking about the teens or the 2010s or whatever. It sounds so weird.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're talking about the wrong century, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I guess in the teens it was very big, and the whole artisanal, is that a word?
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, organic, locally sourced.
Yeah.
Sustainable.
And also for design, I think that whole handmade vibe was coming back.
Yeah.
And you were there not only doing it, but also showing it, which again, like with the nerd who can also go on stage.
Yeah.
Kind of have the best of both worlds there.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, I think if you've got an interesting story to tell, you know, people are, you know, every time, you know, when I do workshops or, you know, show people how to screen print and things, you know, there's real, you know, people are fascinated by these bygone techniques that that have a kind of inkiness and a tactility and a smell and a texture that you don't get on a, you know, on screen.
Yeah, I talked to Erik Spiekermann in Berlin, and he has, he has changed pretty much to working with all the analog stuff now, and has his printing presses, and has, I think, like the biggest private collection of certain very, very old presses stuff, and has all these workshops. He also said people are going mad for it. They're loving it, touching it and smelling it and just having the print and all that. I think it's, I mean, it's, I'm not saying anything new here to anyone, but I think we need that as a to balance the digital thing to actually make something with our hands.
Yeah. Well, when I was at art school, you know, in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, the big push was to go digital. So, you know, lots of places got rid of their letterpress collections and their, you know, their presses, you know, they'd all just get thrown out in skips. And, you know, it's the places, you know, like with Eric's collection, you know, it's kind of like, it's keep, you know, being able to look after that stuff, you know, it's part of our history of, you know, visual communication. And it's still a really important part of, you know, learning about typography, especially, you know, by physically handling wood and metal, you know, it's great.
Gives you a whole different, well, way of interacting with it, right? I mean, it's pushing it around on screen. And I mean, you can be really precise with the kerning and everything, and I guess it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I mean, when it's all of a sudden, it's like a real object in the world, I imagine that is, you have a different relationship to the type then, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you kind of feel like part of history as well, and you kind of feel connected with, you know, it's like all the typefaces I use are from, you know, 100 years ago. So you kind of feel, you know, they were designed to advertise and to shout really loud and be bold and strong. And, you know, the suffragettes used them, you know, in all their kind of campaigning. And it feels like, you know, I'm kind of part of that, you know, string of history.
And I think you said you've never worked with assistants in your studio, right? So
no.
Everything that comes out of there, everything that goes through there goes through your hands.
Yeah. I kind of work collaboratively. So, you know, with different printers and, you know, kind of friends who are kind of making things, but yeah, I don't have assistants in the studio. My wife kind of helps me, you know, like the kind of business side of things, and, you know, and we constantly talk about ideas together. Mm-hmm. You know, we're both, you know, she was at art school as well. She's super creative, and, you know, I think, I don't know, I like to be 100% self-sufficient within that, you know. It wouldn't feel right for me to, you know, kind of rely on anybody else to make the work.
Well, after it took us a few times to actually get on a call together, and now we had a few technical difficulties. I didn't pay for Zoom, and now I have to.
All right, okay, yeah.
I think this is a very good point to end this conversation. And
great.
Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for lugging your iMac into your living room.
Well, you know, that's my pleasure. It's been a really good chat. I just feel like we could chat for hours about this stuff.
Yeah,
you
know,
I think you've definitely kind of understood the context of me and my work, and, you know, kind of coming through similar periods of time, and, you know, how those, like you said, the four different phases of my career, you know, it's all those things are, you know, stuff that I kind of think about, and, you know, how those things relate, and then what's going to happen next, you know, what's going to be in the fifth phase, you know, hopefully something interesting and creative.
But do you think you're coming towards the end of that fourth phase, and you are moving into something new?
Yeah, it kind of feels different now. You know, it kind of feels like there's going to be something else that kind of comes along that I'm going to start doing, you know, that is maybe connected with stuff that I've been doing over the past few years, but kind of changes and, you know, maybe slightly different direction, you know, acoustic guitar songs or something, you know, I don't know yet.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
If you like this episode, I have a few recommendations for you. Let me see. For example, there was an episode 82, Paula Schur, just recently. Paula is definitely one of my idols, one of the people I really look up to. In the early 2000s, I want to say, when I started working, she was, well, not at the height of her career. I think she's still at the same level or even higher now. But we had a fantastic conversation all about her life. Then in episode 80, I met Luc DeLeo, and he works for Swapfeeds. I met him really by coincidence when I was on vacation in Thailand, and we had a very nice talk over a beer on the beach. And someone who has been speaking, I think, at the same conferences as Anthony sometimes was Eike Koenig. We talked twice, actually, and the last time was for episode 57, where he told me all about his switch from design to art.
Thanks for listening and for your support. And I'll be back next week with another episode. Das war's für heute. Falls du gerade eine von den älteren Folgen hörst, ist es gut möglich, dass du jetzt ein zweites Outro hörst. Lass dich aber nicht von mir verwirren. Ich bin gerade dabei, ein paar Änderungen zu machen. Und dafür muss ich 150 Folgen neu schneiden und nochmal uploaden. Du kannst dir wahrscheinlich vorstellen, dass das ein kleines bisschen dauert. Falls du mich und die Show supporten möchtest, gibt es dafür ein paar Möglichkeiten. Auf patreon.com/svenzaro gibt es jede Woche Bonusmaterial, exklusiv nur für Supporter. Und das für nur ein paar Euro im Monat, mit denen du mir helfen kannst, ohne den Hype noch lange, lange für dich weitermachen zu können. Es hilft natürlich auch immens, wenn die Show wächst, und dazu kannst du deinen Teil beitragen, indem du deinen Kollegen und Kolleginnen davon erzählst. Freunde, Familie, du weißt am besten, für wen das noch was sein könnte. Und zu guter Letzt, falls du es noch nicht gemacht hast, bewerte die Show jetzt gleich mit 5 Sternen in deiner Podcast-App. Im Newsletter gibt es übrigens jede Woche völlig kostenlos inspirierende Tipps von meinen Gästen und mir. Den kannst du auf ohnehinhype.substack.com abonnieren. Und alle Links findest du, wie immer, direkt auch hier in der Beschreibung und natürlich auf ohnehinhype.com. Im Archiv gibt es noch eine Unmenge anderer Gespräche. Unter anderem waren schon mit dabei Stefan Sagmeister, Mirko Borsche, Paula Schör, Mike Mire, Jeremy Format, Jonas Lindström, Mathilde Mutant, Olaf Heine, Eike König, Erich Spiegermann und. Scroll einfach mal durch. Wir sind bei über 150 Folgen, wie gesagt. Und um ehrlich zu sein, kann ich selber kaum fassen, dass ich das Glück hatte, mit so vielen inspirierenden Menschen sprechen zu dürfen. Vielen Dank an Dominik Huber und Marc Kappeler von Moiré. Von denen stammt nämlich die neue Hausschrift der Show, und die heißt GT Pressura. GT steht übrigens für Grilly Type, über die die Schrift zu mir kam. Und auch nochmal vielen Dank an Tobias Rechsteiner fürs Vermitteln. Der größte Dank geht aber natürlich an dich fürs Einschalten, fürs Zuhören und für deinen Support. Und wir hören uns dann hoffentlich nächste Woche wieder.